morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to Ana Pacheco, who is the editor of La Herencia magazine right here in Santa Fe. And we're also going to be speaking to KSFR's own news director, Bill Dupuy. Right now, I would like to welcome Shelby Tisdale. She is the director of the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Thank you for having me on this morning.
It's a pleasure, as always, to have you here and to talk about this fine museum that I stopped in just for a little while yesterday. We're talking today about an exhibition called Native Couture, A History of Santa Fe Style.
Yes.
Now, Santa Fe style, I suppose at first glance you think of the architecture and that style that was really very consciously put in place in the early 20th century, but this is about personal style, clothing and jewelry and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's also that kind of sense of place. You know, Santa Fe is so unique. I mean, that's why we call Santa Fe the city different. And Santa Fe style, as you said, really, when we think of it, its origination came from John Gaumee and his wonderful revival Hispanic Pueblo architectural style that we see all around Santa Fe is really kind of what was the basis of Santa Fe style. And then in the 40s, 50s, a lot of women started wearing the pleated skirts and a lot of Indian jewelry. And then in the 60s and 70s in particular, it really took off.
And so what are the origins of it? I mean, is this a sort of multicultural combination pastiche kind of thing?
It really is. I mean, I think it's kind of it has its beginnings, of course, with a lot of the pioneer women coming out to the West and having their big full skirts. And the Navajos started to adapt that style of a skirt and then kind of a tight blouse with a very tight bodice. And then they started making them in velvets and so on. And, of course, the fiesta outfits are kind of another area that all this is kind of combined into one style that we kind of recognize now as Santa Fe style.
Is it a girl thing?
It's very much a girl thing, but men also have adapted a particular style, too, and it's kind of that Western look with the addition of a Native American bolo tie and maybe a concha belt. And men will wear banded bracelets and things like that, too. I mean, there are certain jewelry styles that are made specifically for men.
It was interesting looking at this exhibition because some of the origins of some of the jewelry are functional origins. For example, this wristband, which was actually a Native American functional thing that you put around your wrist to protect the wrist from the snapping of a bow.
Right. They're bow guards, and the Navajo term for those are katos. And they started out just as solid leather and had absolutely that very practical, functional purpose. Then they started adding silver about the 1880s. They started adding silver on top to give it a little more of a decorative look. And now, today, most of them are worn, particularly at ceremonies, as part of the ceremonial regalia.
So let's talk about this amazing woman who is pictured there, Dickie Feltzer.
Dickie Feltzer, well, how this exhibit actually came to be was because of the donation of her jewelry collection to the museum in 2005 by her children. And Dickie Feltzer is, a lot of people recall Dickie, and I do myself. I remember when I first lived here in the early 80s, I would see her on the plaza and always thought she was so beautiful, and I would see her at Elaine Horowitz's gallery, which is where she worked. But oftentimes she would give breaks to some of the Indian artists that were working under the portal, selling their wares under the portal. And oftentimes during her lunch break, she would go and give them a lunch break or, you know, a potty break or something like that. And she had a lot of Native American friends. And she loved their jewelry. And there are some wonderful stories about Dickie. I mean, I used to see her a lot. And a lot of people just remember seeing her. And she really emulated that whole concept of Santa Fe style. beautifully adorned in all this gorgeous jewelry. And there's a wonderful story that her daughter tells that when she would get dressed in the morning, she would bend over, and if she could get up very quickly, she didn't have enough necklaces on, and she would put more necklaces on. Her daughter also said that even at home on her day off, when she wasn't coming into work, she always dressed to the nines. And she
I think that's the opposite of functionality.
It is. It's really, you know, personal adornment is something that's universal. We all like to, you know, every culture in the world has some form of adornment. It might be tattooing, it might be jewelry, it might be some other form of decoration, might be fashion of some sort. And I think here in the Southwest, because of the combination of the multicultural aspects that we have here, the adornment aspect of our daily lives, I think, has taken on much more importance. One of the reasons we also highlight a lot of the contemporary Native American artists is because that's the new Santa Fe style. And a lot of women that we talked to that came to a meeting that we had, luncheon that we had at the museum, they were all talking about the different artists they were wearing. You know, they had different types of jewelry, and they go, oh, this is so-and-so, and this is so-and-so, and really identified with the artists. And that seems to be kind of where the new Santa Fe style is going today.
Another story that cracked me up about Dickie Feltzer is that she was sitting in the Portal selling jewelry for somebody who'd taken a break, and these German tourists came up to her and said in German, as if she were an ignorant Indian who couldn't understand German, oh, these are factory made. And, of course, her name is German. She spoke perfect German.
Right, and she replied to them in German.
Right.
And it really shocked them, and she replied to them in German saying, no, these are all handmade. And that's one of the points we're trying to really get across in this exhibit, too, is every piece in the exhibit is unique. It's handmade and still being handmade today. And it's so beautiful. We also have a little section in the exhibit that has a lot of the tools and materials that a lot of the jewelry is made out of. And not all of the materials come from this area. A lot of things have to be imported, especially some of the different gems or the different materials, like some of the shell. Coral, for example, comes from the Mediterranean area, especially Italy. And then, you know, you've also got the stamp work, and you can look at the ends of those stamps and see, you know, the wonderful different designs that the Indian artists used to stamp into their jewelry, into the silver.
Now, there's a lot of, a really disproportionate number of Navajo silversmiths when you think of all the Native people we have in New Mexico and in the Southwest. Why so many Navajo silversmiths?
Well, you're absolutely right. And it's because back in the 1860s, the Navajos were the ones to first pick it up. They learned from the Mexicans, silversmiths that were traveling up and forth. Early on, it was trade, and then the Navajo silversmiths started to actually learn how to do it. And it started with some early silversmiths, like at Sidi Chan, for example, is really the first one to really get it started, and then Slim Silvermaker, and there's a wonderful photo of Slim in the exhibit. And it was after that that some of the Pueblos started to pick up silver work, too. The Navajos were living on the Zuni Reservation and trained the Zunis to do silver work. So some of that early Zuni silver work is sometimes a combination of Navajo and silver. And then as the Zuni started to get better at it, they started to do more and more silver work and then came up with their own style. And then some of the members of Santo Domingo Pueblo started picking up doing silver work also. But, of course, Santo Domingo and a lot of the southern Pueblos, especially around the Albuquerque area, are much better known for their turquoise beadwork.
Now, turquoise is an interesting example of a stone that became popular when Tiffany's in New York, the very fine, expensive jewelry store, started selling turquoise jewelry.
That's right. And actually, the Cerrillos mine that's just south of Santa Fe was owned by Tiffany back in the late 1800s. And the turquoise in that area was mined specifically for Tiffany and shipped back to Tiffany. And Tiffany did beautiful, gorgeous turquoise jewelry. And of course, the Cerrillos mine has an interesting history because a lot of the native peoples would mine their turquoise there. For example, Santo Domingo used to go over, families from there used to go over and mine the turquoise from that area. And, of course, when Tiffany bought it, that became a source of contention because the Santo Domingans were no longer allowed to go over and mine this turquoise.
How long had Indians been using turquoise?
Oh, for centuries and centuries. We find it in an archaeological context. And it's interesting because right now we're actually in the process of planning an exhibition just on turquoise. And we know of turquoise caches from Chaco Canyon. And we're doing some testing on that right now to try to identify where that turquoise comes from. And the assumption was that that turquoise always came from around this area. But some of the turquoise that we've tested through, I can't think of the term offhand, but it's a non-destructive type of testing, and it's testing isotopes or something along that line. Maybe wrong in terms of the term, but we found that a lot of the turquoise in this one cache from Chetrocattle at Chaco Canyon actually came from northern Nevada, from the number 8 mines. So we're kind of looking at now changing a lot of our assumptions, which is wonderful because we've got the scientific tools to do the analysis.
We're talking to Shelby Tisdale, who is the director of the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, and this exhibition, Native Couture, it's on for the next few months.
It's actually going to be up for a year and a half.
Okay.
It's got a long run. We figured this one would be a very popular exhibit, so we wanted to keep it up a little longer than we normally do.
I have to say, when I first moved here in the early 90s, I had a friend visit from Alaska, and she walked, I went to work, and she walked around Santa Fe all day, and then we both came home. And she had this very puzzled expression on her face, and she said, "Are the women in costume?" And Santa Fe style, it is sort of a costume.
It's a costume, it's a look, it's a style, again, it's what I said at the beginning of the program, it's that sense of place, because you don't find this anywhere else. In some places in Arizona, women would wear this kind of style a little bit too with some moccasins. And when Millicent Rogers first came to New Mexico in the 1940s, she immediately adapted it as her style too. And I think it's part a self-identity, but at the same time, it's a style that you can just mix and match and get away with a lot of different things.
And say, "I am from here."
That's right. Because you don't go to, say, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and see people dressed like this.
No.
And there's another great story about Dickie in New York, because her daughter, who lives here now, is from New York City. And her mother, Dickie, was back visiting her one day, and they were standing on a corner in New York City, and they were talking to each other, and then Dickie went in a different direction. I don't know, was probably going to Saks Fifth Avenue or something. I have no idea. But a man came up to her daughter and said, "Is that Indian bothering you?" She said, "No, that's my mother."
Heavens.
So and that's the one thing about Dickie in particular. I think a lot of women will dress in that Santa Fe style here, but then if they go somewhere like New York or Chicago, they'll maybe not dress that way.
They'll tone it down.
And Dickie never did. She would travel to India. She traveled all over the place. Wherever she went, that's how she looked all the time.
Are there other connections between Santa Fe style and high fashion of, you know, New York, Paris, that kind of thing?
I think that's where, you know, where Native American couture, in particular, Native couture, that kind of haute couture, but it's very much identified with Native designers, especially here from the Southwest. These artists are just, they're stars. They're just taking off. I mean, Virgil Ortiz went back to New York and worked with Donna Karen, developing a fashion style of some sort. He's certainly got his own trademark. He's really getting to be so famous and well-known, not just here in the United States or even in the Southwest, but beyond, I mean, in Europe. Penny Singer is another one who's just, she's just a, like a star that's just taking off. Patricia Michaels, of course, is so well-known for her really kind of avant-garde style, painted, wonderful painted silks and so on. And Pilar Arguello, another really wonderful fashion designer. We have that one dress by her, that red and black one, which is kind of her trademark, is working more in vinyls and things like that. She's working for a movie right now, doing the fashion design. So I think these artists are really breaking out of the mold, very much like Lloyd Kivenu did in the 60s. And these artists are doing fashion shows in New York, in L.A., and in Europe. And I think it's so exciting to see what's happening with these artists. And then there certainly are some fashion design, Native American fashion designers from other parts of the country, too, especially from the Northwest Coast. But I think these artists in particular, they're like stars that are just, they're just sailing through the sky right now. They're so fantastic.
Is there a split between or a dialogue between the people who are doing very traditional arts and the people who are really taking off into a more sort of contemporary look, whether it be crafts or clothing or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Definitely there is. There's certainly, and what I'm finding with all of these artists that are doing all this wonderful, very, what we would call contemporary, progressive, avant-garde, haute couture, are all based in very much traditions within their Pueblo communities. I mean, Virgil Ortiz, for example, is a potter. And you know, it's a tradition that runs in his family, and he still does pottery. Patricia, she's a fashion designer, but she's very, very involved in Taos Pueblo and all that's going on there. And I think that's the one thing about all of these artists, they have those deep roots, and that it's part of that tradition, that what we call that kind of way of learning that's been passed on from generation to generation. They're kind of taking it into a next kind of phase. And
how would you characterize that way of learning?
Well, I think some of it has to do with the fact that a lot of these artists have gone to IAIA, and they've been exposed to different types of art, as well as they've had teachers from elsewhere. And so they come in and they learn something very differently than what they're learning at home in the Pueblo. And they're taking those two and they're combining them. And they're just expanding the horizons of what they're doing. I see this in jewelry also. And as anthropologists and art historians, we kind of make this dichotomy of tradition and contemporary as if this is something new and different. But when you look through thousands of years of history, cultures have always changed.
And they've always blended with one another.
They've always blended with other. If they see something that somebody else is doing, they go, oh, that's cool, I think that would work here, they'll try it. And there's a lot of exchange of ideas. I think the other thing is so many of these young artists travel. They travel around the world. They see a lot more. And I think as outsiders, we tend to think of people frozen in time and oh, they just live in these pueblos or in reservations and they really don't go anywhere. And it's the total opposite. I know some of these artists have studied in Italy. It's a different world today, and we live in a global community, so there's a lot more exchange going on.
But and reservations are not self-contained economies in the first place, whereas 700 years ago,
you're
it was
absolutely
a completely different
right.
story.
You're absolutely right. And I heard one artist, young jewelry artist, explain it, that, you know, there's traditional work, and their work is all still steeped in that tradition because everything's still handmade, the tools are the same, none of that's changed. And then there's this kind of contemporary phase, which really came out of a lot of the influence of people like Charles Loloma, for example. These younger artists today consider themselves more progressive and not so contemporary, but really progressive because they're really getting out there and doing some really unique, crazy things. A lot of people will come up to me, and some of the pieces are in our exhibit. They'll go, "Well, how could you wear that?" You know, it's hard to think of how you could wear some of these pieces of jewelry, these progressive pieces of jewelry. But I've seen them worn, and they're absolutely gorgeous, just beautiful.
Has doing this exhibition or seeing this exhibition made you dress differently?
No, I wish I could dress differently. I just admire it. You know, I love jewelry, and I like to wear a lot of jewelry when I have the opportunity to do it, especially when I dress up or something like that. And I love the work that some of these young artists are doing today. And a lot of those artists are represented in our Native Treasures show that we do every year now on Memorial Day weekend. We invite over 100 artists to come up to the museum, and we have a big show and sale. And it benefits both the artists as well as the museum. And some of the artists that are in this particular exhibit will be in that show this year.
Tell us a little bit about the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture. There's a lot of stuff going on there. There's some ancient traditional arts, and there's a whole laboratory aspect of it.
That's right. I'm the director of both the museum and the Laboratory of Anthropology, and we have in our collections, we have over 10 million archaeological objects, and we are the state repository for
archaeological objects.
And it's continuing to grow, and we are the state repository for any kind of archaeological project going on in the state. And about 50% of our collections are federally owned, which means we are also the repository for, you know, like the Bureau of Land Management, Forest Service, and some of those or different federal agencies. And right now, we're in the process of building an off-site research and curation facility for those collections.
Do you still have stuff coming in? People dig things up by mistake or find things on the ground?
Yes, and we're required by law to take those in as the state repository. So our collections are constantly growing. And then in our in the museum, we have about 75,000 works of art and ethnographic materials, a lot of textiles, baskets, pottery. And we're trying... Our museum is a little different in that we don't do a lot of traveling exhibits. We really focus on our collections because we feel that our collections are some of the best collections in the country. And we really want to have an opportunity for visitors and researchers to see more of our collection.
Well, and I mean, with all of those objects that are in, you know, climate-controlled areas and they don't get to see the light of day or even just more than a few eyes...
Right.
I mean, you sort of owe it to the public to put them out.
Absolutely. And, you know, all of these collections are held in public trust. I mean, these collections are held for the citizens of New Mexico. And they're there for the citizens of New Mexico to see, as well as access for research or anything else. The other thing we're doing right now is we are digitizing our collections. So we are hoping within the next couple of months to have some of our collections actually accessible through our website. But one of the things we are going to be doing in the next couple of weeks probably is we will have a large part of our collections that have already been digitized. These will be mostly the pottery collection and the jewelry collection, and our fine art collection will be accessible through our computers in our library. We have quite an extensive library at the Laboratory of Anthropology, and we have... I think four terminals in there that are accessible to the public. I mean, the public can come in and use our library
do
anytime.
They do that?
They do. Most of it's anthropologists and archaeologists, but we certainly, you know, open our library to the public, and it's open from 10 to 4 Tuesday, Monday through Friday. So. You know, we're hoping it'd be great, you know, if people want to come in, and that's going to be another way to see our collection, because you're right, probably only about 2% of our collection is ever on exhibit at any one time.
What are the areas that anthropologists and archaeologists are focusing on these days in terms of Indian arts?
Well, it runs the gamut. We have a number of different anthropologists right now who are researching our collections because they're writing books about maybe a particular pueblos, pottery, for example. There's one book that's being done on the Zuni pottery. And we have another researcher who's working on a section of our basket collection. It was a collection that was put together of Great Basin basketry by a particular anthropologist. And so we have this researcher now who's working on this collection with the purpose of writing an article about it. And then in terms of archaeology, a lot of times people come in to look at our collections. We just had a researcher at the museum yesterday who's looking at yucca fiber sandals that come out of a couple of different archaeological sites in the northwest section of New Mexico.
So these are ancient preserved sandals?
Yes, and they're beautiful. They're really something to see.
It's going to be in the next style exhibit, one of these days.
Yeah, right. Well, that would be great, wouldn't it, to have some of the textiles and archaeological textiles and sandals. That would actually be a great exhibit. But they came in and they just, they're taking little samples of that because they're going to have those tested to find out how old they are. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that happens a lot is other researchers will come in and test things or do more research on some of the archaeological collections. You know, I think a lot of people think, oh, 10 million objects, and those are just stored in boxes, never to be seen, and actually they are. We have constant requests by researchers who want to come in and look at the collections because they're doing comparative analysis of some of the things they found in a site they've worked at recently or something along that line.
Is there an increasing number of Native American scholars doing this kind of research?
I don't know that it's increasing, but it's ongoing.
Uh-huh.
There are a lot of scholars out there who are interested in Native American art, in archaeology, of course. And one of the things with archaeology, too, is, you know, there's every time any kind of construction goes on, you have to have an archaeologist come on site and make sure there's not a major archaeological site or something there. And so, and if there is, then some work has to be done to at least do surface surveys and maybe some excavation. Those collections will come to us, and oftentimes there might be a site nearby that they can compare what they're finding in this site to what's already been found and reported on. That's the other thing. We have all the site records at the Laboratory of Anthropology also. So those get accessed a lot, maps, people doing research.
And you're overseeing the whole thing. Just tell us before we go, what are the exhibitions besides the Native Couture that are on exhibit right now at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture?
Well, right now we still have an exhibit on Poblita Velarde.
Yes, we talked about that last year.
Yeah, we did. And that'll be closing in April. It'll be up for a couple more months. And we're getting ready to do a small exhibit on artists that were that did work during the New Deal, because this year is the 75th anniversary of the New Deal.
That's right.
And we're working with Kathy Flynn and her group to have a symposium at the museum on April 5th. And then we're going to have an opening for our exhibit with New Deal artists that are represented in our collection. So it'll be fun to get those artists out, because Poblita Velarde was also an artist from that time period. So that's why we wanted to keep that exhibit up until about mid-April, so it would tie in with the New Deal. And of course, you know, the WPA was so important to her beginning.
That's
in
right.
Getting her started.
That's right. Well, Shelby Tisdale, thank you so much for being with us here on KSFR.
Mary Charlotte, it's always a pleasure. Thank
Likewise.
You so much.
Shelby Tisdale is the director of the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, and the exhibition is called Native Couture, A History of Santa Fe Style. We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Ana Pacheco of La Herencia. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Ana Pacheco. She is the editor and publisher of La Herencia. Welcome.
Good morning and Happy New Year to all your listeners.
Happy New Year to you, too. Tell us, first of all, about what La Herencia is. We haven't had you on the air for a while.
Well, La Herencia means the heritage, and I started the publication in the spring of 1994, so we're now in our 14th year of publication. And basically, it's just a way of trying to preserve Hispanic culture and heritage here in New Mexico.
And Hispanic culture and heritage, specifically New Mexican, it seems like you also cross over into, you know, all the way down to Chiapas, southern Mexico. There's there's a broad scope.
Well, you know, in the early days, the magazine used to be called La Herencia del Norte, and people kind of thought that that was just about Santa Fe and northern New Mexico, but really initially my intention was to talk about all of the heritage from the trail. What is the trail now? I can't.
Santa Fe Trail?
No. But anyway, it was supposed to start from Chihuahua all the way up to southern Colorado.
All right.
So that's what that was.
Camino Real?
The Camino Real. There you go. Thank you very much. So that was my intention. So, yeah, periodically we will touch on different parts of Mexico and stuff, but primarily the magazine's focus is on the old Spanish families that settled here almost 400 years ago.
And is that your own heritage?
Yeah, my family came here in the early 1600s. So we weren't the very first wave of settlers, but we were probably the second wave, yes. Both my mom and dad's family came in around early 1623s. I've gone back that far.
Very interesting. So you, in the magazine, you have all sorts of writers and have a wide variety of subjects. But let's talk today about Doña Tules, who is a great character about whom there is a new book by Mary Jane Straw Cook.
Yeah, I just kind of was struck with this. This is a year ago at this time. I actually read an older book that was published in 1948 called The Wind Leaves No Shadow by Margaret Laughlin. And I was so taken with the book, and people had been telling me for years, you've got to read it. And apparently back in the 1960s, it was required reading in high school. So a lot of my cousins and friends who are in their 60s were in high school at that time, so they all read it. So I finally got around to reading it, and I was so taken with this woman's life. And it's a fictional account, but I was so taken by her that we published a story on her in the winter 2007 issue of La Herencia. And then there was never a nice depiction of her or painting or photo or anything. This was back in the 1840s. There was this really awful sketch that some guy, I think from Harper's Magazine, did or something. So if you go to the photo archives here doing some research, you'll just find this really unattractive sketch of this woman with a cigarette hanging out of her mouth. So I got to thinking last year about, wouldn't it be nice if there was a better depiction of this woman who apparently captured the imagination of so many writers and people? I mean, she's been published in all types of magazines back in New York back in the turn of the last century. There's at least four or five books on her, and there's references to her all over the place. So I commissioned Diana Breyer, the artist Diana Breyer, who lives up in Santa Cruz, to do a painting on Doña Tules. And so now if you subscribe to La Herencia for 2 years, you get a free offset lithograph of Doña Tules in her gambling hall.
Now, this is a very interesting person. I mean, she was a, she's a wife, a mother, she was a madam, she was a gambler, she was an entrepreneur. All sorts of things. It's hard to make sense of her, and you can see why her life lends itself so much to fiction, because there's so much legend around her. It's very hard to sort out what the truth was.
Yeah, she was certainly bigger than, she was bigger, larger than life, as they say. But, what's really, I think, remarkable is that she was a Hispanic woman. If you think back 150 years ago, women had no rights at all. I mean, women were really kind of obscure and in the house. And for a Hispanic woman to have kind of reached this magnitude of power, basically what happened was she started this Monte Hall, this gambling hall, and then later on it became a brothel as well. But she was very close. She was the lover of Governor Armijo at the time. He was a married man, but she became...
And she was a married woman.
No, at that point she wasn't.
Okay.
No, her husband had been murdered. According to this fictional account, anyway, I'm not really sure, but she definitely was the mistress of Governor Armijo, who was the last Mexican governor before New Mexico was annexed from Mexico to the United States. But anyway, she became the confidant of him, and then with the Catholic Church. I mean, even though she was a gambler and she ran a brothel, the Catholic Church respected her, her power and her money. So, and then the Americans came in, and she was, so she was basically a very powerful political figure in New Mexico. And again, that is so unusual for a woman of any ethnicity, but especially a Hispanic woman back then.
And all this was taking place on Burrow Alley.
Yeah, it's up there. And it's actually with the old, where the old courthouse is. That's where her property actually was. And then, the governor actually lived where the palace the governor's is now. All right in that little plaza area, that was all taking place right there.
So, Doña Tules, how has her legacy affected people? I mean, is she somebody I was reading about her and thinking, is she a role model for women? She was very powerful, but powerful in ways that maybe we don't aspire to, or maybe we do.
You know, I tend to think that she is. I mean, maybe this is a different time. I'm sure, you know, when there's an account, my great-grandmother really didn't like her because she was, you know, they were very Catholic and very religious. But I think in this day and age, I think women or most people would see her as a role model because she basically started from nothing, and she did a lot of good. She was, you know, she used to help people. According to, again, what I've read, she helped people, you know, people that she was a poor woman at one point, so she would give her money to the poor people, so people would come to her for help. So I see her as a role model, and I also see her, you know, because she was so independent and strong, you know, somebody that you should aspire to. I mean, we're all independent women now, but think about, you know, even 50 years ago, what life was like here.
That's right. So if we go make a fortune through card playing, we are well on our way to walking in her footsteps.
Exactly.
Not to mention the prostitution angle maybe is not so.
Well,
much.
See, she wasn't a prostitute, but I think she helped a lot of women.
Yeah, but she was. I mean, she ran a brothel.
Right, but again, I think she was trying to. She was actually in a way helping a lot of these women who had no other means of support. So in a way, she was kind of the. She was the. I guess you know she was the broker, whatever you'd like, or the pimp, whatever you'd like to say. But she was basically she was helping a lot of people. But yes, it was a brothel and it was a gambling hall.
We're talking to Ana Pacheco of La Herencia. So what does this lithograph of Doña Tules look like? I mean, one of the interesting things is that the accounts of her are often very negative, written by people who one think might have been threatened by her power and her presence. So, what you know, and as you say, that one surviving sketch of her paints her in a very negative light. What does the lithograph look like that you had commissioned?
Well, it's a 16 by 20 offset lithograph, and it shows her at her Monte table dealing cards, and it's the old Spanish cards. It's not like the poker cards that you see now. They're like, and Diana did all the research to make sure it was all correct. So it's the different Monte cards, shows the different cards on it. It shows Governor Armijo. It shows an Anglo a trader that was coming through. It shows a priest is in the photo. There's people dancing in the brothel. There's a big chandelier. It's all in color. And if you really, if you're interested in just taking a look at what the lithograph looks like, you can go to our website at www.herencia.com, and it's online. You can see a picture of it there. But basically, just kind of shows her in her, you know, in her element, playing cards with all the men. She's surrounded by men, and she's definitely in power. She does have a cigarette. And Diana, she explains in her note to the art from the artist when you get the lithograph, is that basically that was really a symbol of independence for women smoking way back then. So she is. And I know smoking's really bad right now, but
the lithograph is not an endorsement of smoking.
No, of course not. But it does kind of show. It's to depict an era and to kind of give you an indication of what type of woman this was.
We're talking to Ana Pacheco. Now, you are from Santa Fe way back, but you left town for some years. What'd you do?
In 1976, I was 19. I was a theater major at the College of Santa Fe, and I had this actress, Kim Stanley. She was teaching at the college. She was this big, incredible Broadway legend. And she kept telling me that I should just go to New York. She talked me into quitting college, which I did, and she told me to go to New York to be a writer. But I wanted to go to New York and be an actress, and that didn't work out. So I did get into writing and publishing, and so I left for New York City in 1976, and I lived there for 16 years. I came back at the end of 1991 to take care of my mother, who was dying of cancer. So basically, for about 3 years, I did acting, but then I did go into publishing and writing. So it's really funny how it all worked out. And my grandfather was an editor at the New Mexican back in the 1930s, and I never, ever thought I would. It's like funny how this all kind of has fallen together, because I had no idea 30 years ago I'd be doing what I'm doing today.
So you came back to take care of your mother, but did you also think at that time that you wanted to look into this whole area of Hispanic heritage?
Well, you know, since I had been working in publishing, I came back here and I noticed how different in 16 years what had happened to Santa Fe and just the whole surrounding area and how people were moving out. And I just felt that what I knew how to do was publishing, and I should try and, you know, capture some of this culture because it was dying out with my parents' generation. And so I just decided to start this quarterly publication.
What kind of writing and publishing were you doing in New York?
Well, my last job, which was really kind of a sweet deal until 9/11 hit, was I was working in international banking. I was the publisher of an international banking magazine. So I'd fly all over the world selling ads to banks, you know, in Germany and Egypt and all over. So that was a really cool job. But prior to that, I've done all kinds of publishing. I worked for general consumer magazines, women's publications, music magazines, entertainment. So I had a real thorough background in magazine publishing back in New York.
Now, one of the cliches of people who've been in Santa Fe for a long time is that they talk about how much better it was before. And you just talked about being away for 16 years and seeing how much it changed. How do you feel about the ways in which Santa Fe has changed in your lifetime?
Well, you know, I kind of prefer it. When I lived here, this was a little known up in town. I mean, I couldn't wait to leave. I mean, you would get movies like 3 months after everybody else saw them. And it was just a real kind of, I mean, with technology, everything is so different. And I really like the fact that there's so much more diversity now. But then again, I lived in New York, so I was used to living with all kinds of people. So I actually prefer it. And it's just, you know, it's the world we live in now. Everything is different. But if you ask me if I liked New York better now or then, I tell you, New York was way better in the 70s and 80s than it is now. So that's my perspective. But for Santa Fe, I'm actually pleased to live here because it's a small town, but it's got a lot of things that other small towns certainly don't have.
Ana Pacheco is the publisher and editor of La Herencia, and you can check it out at Herencia, HERENCIA.org. You can check
.com.
.com, sorry. And you can check out the lithograph of Doña Tules and all the other articles, and you can also subscribe to it. And it's a large format magazine that comes right to your house.
And the nice thing about it is it's the information is not timely, so you can take your leisurely time reading it. And most people never throw it out because the information you get is really invaluable, a type of historic and cultural information that you're never going to find. So it stays around for a long time. And I just have to do another plug for Diana Breyer, the artist up there. She's an incredible artist. I've been an admirer of her work for years. And you should get the lithograph. If for no other reason, it's because Diana Breyer did it.
Ana Pacheco, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
We're going to take a little break right now. When we come back, we'll be talking to news director Bill Dupuy of KSFR. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Bill Dupuy. He's the news director of KSFR, and he's speaking to us from the studios of KSFR while I am here in the Santa Fe Baking Company. Welcome.
I appreciate being with you, Mary Charlotte, having breakfast here in our luxurious KSFR newsroom while you have breakfast at the Baking Company.
Yes, indeed. We are coming up on, just in a few days, is the 6th birthday of KSFR and the 6th anniversary of the KSFR news department as well. How did the news department get started?
Well, it was a guiding tenet of the early idea for KSFR that we would have entertainment, of course, but do a great deal in terms of local news, as there was very little happening except the newspapers and it was sporadic television reports from Santa Fe. And so we made a pledge to focus on local news, and we've done that these past 6 years.
And when did you come in, and how'd you get involved?
Well, I was involved from the very beginning, volunteering. You know, it's an all-volunteer news department, except I now receive a stipend pay as news director. But everyone else is a volunteer on the news team, a dozen people or so. And, you know, it's amazing. I calculated the other day that we've done something like 18,000 newscasts, maybe even more since we began doing this. 12 times a day, we do an hour at noon every day. A lot of effort goes into this, and it's paid off. We won a lot of awards, and I think we're taken seriously in town.
What are some of the achievements that you're proudest of in the news department?
Well, it's being there and filling all these holes every hour. We have not missed, except for a power outage or some other unforeseen circumstance, we have not missed a newscast in those 16 years, not a scheduled one at least. And in terms of people paying attention to us, I was going recently over the top most viewed local stories on our website, ksfr.org, and some of the results are kind of surprising. Want to hear them?
Yes, I do.
The most viewed stories, number one and number three of the top 10, have to do with the subject of the job cuts at Los Alamos, the privatization of the Los Alamos National Lab. It's interesting that we've focused on this, and other media really haven't. They've been saying that costs at the lab have gone up. But we've looked at the reason costs have gone up, and that is because the lab is now private. The number of jobs being cut at the lab, 500 to 700 jobs, to achieve a savings of $100 million off the budget, coincidentally equals the amount of the profit the new corporation running the lab wants to get. and the increased gross receipts taxes it's now required to pay by the state of New Mexico. And so that's why the first and third top most viewed and listened to podcast stories on KSFR's website were on that subject. I talked to Congressman Tom Udall. He got the most hits. Senator Jeff Bingaman got the third amount of hits as we raised the question, is privatization of the lab really working to the taxpayers' benefit? And it appears it's coming out of the hide of the employees.
I guess that's what people mean when they say do the math.
Do the math. And why no one else has done the math is beyond me. Other media are talking about increased cost, but the real increases in cost are that profit of $80 million and the extra $35 to $50 million in gross receipts taxes the lab now has to pay as a private corporation.
We're talking to KSFR's news director, Bill Dupuis. You've been following the story about oil and gas drilling in Santa Fe County very closely. Can you summarize this narrative for us?
Well, it's a complex situation, and we're reporting today that the county plans a meeting on Monday to review and present a revised ordinance on oil and gas drilling in the county, and that has some opponents troubled because they fear they may not have a chance to read that ordinance before the meeting. So why have the public meeting? What are they to say? What are they to hear? And then what are they to do? So they're asking for a little bit more time. One of the 10th most viewed story on KSFR's website, hundreds of people took to this one to take a look at it, was the protest that I filed against a Santa Fe County commissioner who held a private meeting with groups in opposition to drilling and with the oil company involved in private and disinvited the media, which to me was a big mistake. Now, he was legal because other commissioners were not there. There was no quorum. There was no need under New Mexico law to publish an agenda, have a notice of the meeting. So all of that was legal. But in my view, legal does not mean always being right, particularly in terms of something of such huge import in Santa Fe as oil and gas drilling. And so the second meeting planned under that scheme has now been called off. Groups said they felt very uncomfortable being there in private and outsiders wondering what was going on. So I think we were right in criticizing it. And again, why didn't other media, except for the New Mexican and the editorial, also take a stand on that issue?
Well, so, it's an interesting and a very important point, which is that the news media and particularly radio and broadcast media have a role in really bringing current events to light in such a way that people can respond and make a difference in real time.
Well, it's not only a role, it's our responsibility, and it's a responsibility of elected officials to make sure that their constituents know what's going on. And if either of us fails in their role, then one or both of us is at fault.
I don't know if you can answer this, but what would you like to know and what do you feel that the public deserves to know as far as this oil and gas drilling story goes?
Well, we're trying to plow through the technical aspects now. Everyone is having a very difficult time. It is impossible, unless you're an expert, to know exactly how this issue should be approached properly. We are hoping, and we're hearing from some groups that they have expert advice on their side, and they're asking the county commission to allow their experts to cooperate in the drafting of the ordinance so that all the bases are covered for the benefit of all. But they're fearing that perhaps they won't get that opportunity, and they're actually saying the county has not employed enough experts to put together a meaningful ordinance.
What so far are the big stories that you foresee for Santa Fe and New Mexico in the new year?
Well, of course, the election of the president, how things are going to turn out for Bill Richardson tonight in Iowa. And we think we already know the polls are indicating he's a distant fourth behind Obama, Clinton, and Edwards, but he's ahead of Joe Biden and Chris Dodd. So that's going to be a very important story coming out of Iowa. And will he stay the course over the next couple of months? Certainly, we think he will into February when the caucus is being held in New Mexico.
Bill Dupuy, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Pleasure to be with you, and the others in the newsroom join me in saying goodbye.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
And thank you for the great news that you bring to us, because I have to say, I listen as I'm getting ready to come to the cafe every single morning. That's where I get a lot of my news. So, Bill Dupuy, doing a marvelous job. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. Or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to hear it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. And if there's any problems or glitches in this whole system, please send me an email at radiocafe@ksfr.org and let me know, because sometimes things happen that I don't even know about. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month, Coleman Hawkins. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow morning, Michael McGarity has a new mystery out, and we're going to be speaking with him. And, of course, the inimitable Robert Knott will be with us as well, because it's Friday and he'll be speaking of the arts. So that and much, much more from KSFR, broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company. My name is Mary Charlotte. Adios.